Welcome, everybody, to the Gluon Internet Seminar on Greener Cleanups, EPA's methodology for understanding and reducing a project's environmental footprint. We have scheduled about 2 hours for this webinar. We expect to be able to cover all of the material in about 1 hour, so that leaves us with a good hour for discussion. For those of you participating on the phone lines, one last check, please make sure your phones are on mute to avoid noises that can interrupt the webinar, and please avoid putting us on hold. We will be having question and answer slots, which I'll announce. So please be aware that if you have a question, you can ask verbally on the phone or through the question mark on your seminar page. If everybody could please go to slide 2 on the webinar, those final housekeeping items I mentioned. If you are on a phone line that does not have the mute button, you can press *6 to mute the phone and #6 to unmute, and that works on cell phones as well as landlines. During the question and answer, remember to take your phone off mute to ask any questions. I'll be moderating the questions, so I'll take the questions that come in over the phone and the internet, and then we'll determine which of the speakers would be the one answering it. The navigation buttons that you see there are the ones that you'll see at the top of your screen. Remember, the speakers will be announcing the slide number when they move to the next slide. So please move the forward button. The question mark button, that's when you can click that on any time, at any time in the seminar, to submit a question, request clarification, etc. We will be receiving all of those, and there'll be a queue for those questions which we'll ask or address to the speakers in the Q&A sessions. So with that, please go to slide number 3. This is our first slide, so at this point, we'll actually start with the seminar. We're done with the housekeeping. One last question. Our speaker, Kira Lynch, are you on the phone?
Yes, I'm on.
Hi, Kira.
Hi.
Great. So we have all the speakers, so we'll go ahead and get started. So again, my name is Carlos Pachon. I'll be introducing the webinar, providing a bit of background. I am with the Superfund program and here in headquarters in the Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. Been working on green remediation topics for the last 3 years. Our second speaker will be Doug Sutton. He's with TechTech Geotrans. Doug has been providing a lot of tech support for our footprint evaluations at pilot projects, and has helped us develop this methodology. Well, then I have Karen Sherman, who's in EPA Region 9 in their RCRA Corrective Action Program. She's done a number of these footprint evaluations, what we call 100% footprint evaluations, and her experience has been really important in us getting to where we are now. Kira Lynch is a remedial project manager in EPA Region 10. Well, now she's currently a liaison with the Office of Research and Development and EPA's Office of Research and Development. And she's had a practical experience managing projects where decisions have been made with respect to green remediation. And finally, we have Hillary Thornton, who's one of the co-chairs for the TSP, Technology Support Program, engineering forum here in EPA, which also has a subcommittee on green remediation. So those are our speakers for today. We'll go to slide number 4, please. This is the pretty much the agenda. The goal for today is to introduce EPA's draft methodology for environmental footprint analysis of remediation projects. The order of the speakers is pretty much the same as you saw before. I'll be covering the introduction and methodology overview. Doug Sutton will be covering the application of the methodology. Karen Sherman, key considerations interpreting the results. Kira Lynch will follow with using the results and then Hillary Thornton will go on to next steps. The methodology is currently in draft form. We are still receiving extensive comments internally here in EPA, and we do expect to receive, hope to receive further comments and have good discussion on the basic concepts of the methodology on this webinar. And we expect to post a PDF version of the entire thing September 9th for public feedback. And there's more discussion on that next steps during the next step session later on. So if we can all go to slide number 6, please. Many of you in the registration are recognized a lot of the names. We've worked together or we've been on conferences, et cetera, and I know that many of you have seen this before. The definition of green remediation that is used here in EPA, the practice of considering all environmental effects of remedy implementation and incorporating options to minimize the environmental footprints of cleanup actions. And why do we continue to put a lot of emphasis on this? Mainly because there significant work remains to be done cleaning up contaminated sites across the country, across cleanup programs. And across all these programs here in EPA, we're working on how we can achieve these cleanups with a lower environmental footprint without changing the endpoint that we're seeking to achieve. So there are many small projects. There are quite a few very large projects. At every one of them, we believe, at almost every one of them, there's an opportunity to reduce the environmental footprint associated with the work needed to achieve the protectiveness. Summed up across all those projects and into the future, that's where we'll start to see a significant difference. If we can all go to slide number 7, please. Slide number 7, for over 2 years, this has been the definition of environmental footprint that we've been using here. It works well to understand overall goals of reducing environmental footprints, but we recognize it does not provide sufficient information to make decisions on a specific project. Those are those 5 core elements that we've been working off of, and today we'll speak in more detail about materials and waste, energy, air, and water. Work continues on land and ecosystems, but we still haven't defined measures or metrics that we'd use in that area. We will be having an internet seminar in October where we'll start to expand further on that topic. Please go to slide number 8. So about 2 years ago, EPA released an overall program-wide policy for OSWER cleanup programs in the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response called Principles for Greener Cleanups. One, 2 points we wanted to highlight from that 3-page document is that, as it states, we can optimize the environmental performance and implement protective cleanups that are greener by increasing our understanding of the environmental footprint and, when appropriate, taking steps to minimize that footprint. In summary, it's intended to provide the decision-making process for cleanup activities in a way that ensures protection of the human health and the environment. More specifically, in the Superfund program, through the Superfund Green Remediation Strategy, we've defined over 40 action items to advance these principles. The methodology we present today is one of those items. Go to slide number 9, please. So what is it about these principles? Main thing to highlight is that consistent with existing laws and regulations, it is OSWER policy that all cleanups will protect human health and the environment, will comply with all applicable laws and regulations, will consult with communities regarding response action impacts consistent with existing regulations, and will consider recommended 5 green remediation core elements. So the main point to make here is that this is an incremental improvement in EPA's cleanup programs. These are not new requirements, and the EPA seeks to lead by example, and today's webinar is intended to share our thinking with a broad audience of practitioners on how we're quantifying environmental footprints at a site level. Slide number 10, please. So on slide number 10, the question that we're asking is, as we mentioned earlier, that the footprint analysis is not required at any of our sites. But you can't measure. You can't manage what you don't measure. So the question is, how do we evaluate the environmental effect of remedy implementation? Step one is to develop metrics associated with the five core elements of green remediation, and we'll discuss four of those today. Step two is to develop a methodology for quantifying those metrics, i.e. the environmental footprint. And step three is to apply the methodology during remedy design, implementation, O&M, and optimization. I'd say that step four, in a sense, is to actually address that environmental footprint. We can say that we apply the Pareto principle, maybe in reverse, where we are seeking 20% of actions that can achieve 80% of footprint reduction. Our goal in developing this methodology was to identify the most significant contributors to the environmental footprint. This is not about chasing down the last NOx molecule at the site cleanup. Go to slide 11, please. So what are these green remediation metrics? The following are the current draft metrics that are being developed to quantify the environmental footprint of cleanup projects. These metrics are program neutral, and we'll expand on them shortly in more detail, but I wanted to give you some of those core elements and associated metrics. And we look forward to hearing your thoughts during this discussion and also in the discussion session, and also in any subsequent written feedback you may provide to this webinar or to the published document when it's released in September. So for energy, what we're looking at is total energy use and percent of that energy from renewables resources. On emissions, we're looking at greenhouse gases, criteria pollutants, nitrogen oxides, SOx, and particulate matter, both on-site emissions and total emissions. We're looking at hazardous air pollutants, both on-site emissions and total emissions. For water, we're looking at on-site water use, including public potable water, and the quality, source of the water, and fate of the water. We're also looking at off-site water use and water table drawdown. Go to slide number 12, please. Regarding materials and waste, we're looking at manufacturing materials used on site, the quantity and percent from recycled materials, bulk unrefined materials used on site, the quantity and percent from recycled materials of these bulk materials, and then waste, hazardous waste generated on site, non-hazardous waste generated on site, percent of total potential waste generated on site that is recycled or reused. And finally, land and ecosystems. Our main focus here is on quantifying ecosystem services available at the site in order to reduce the impacts we may have on those ecosystem services during the execution of a cleanup project. So these are metrics for environmental footprints that we expect to use internally at our projects, working with our contractors, peers, communities, etc. And the purpose of this webinar is to advance a common knowledge on language and understanding of how we quantify an environmental footprint. Go to slide 13, please. So where and when is a methodology used? We believe the methodology process and the results of a footprint evaluation methodology are of value for all types of cleanup projects. They're not specific to any one remedial cleanup approach. They're common to all cleanup programs. and they can be generated and used throughout the cleanup process. In EPA, we're placing a primary purpose, or the primary purpose for generating the footprint information, is to understand what actions can be taken to mitigate the environmental footprint of a selected remedy. The sooner we have the information in the project's timeline, the more time and options we have to take action to reduce that footprint. Let's go to slide 14, please. A couple of clarifications. Does the methodology call for a life cycle assessment, an LCA? And no. However, the methodology does apply life cycle-like concepts, life cycle assessment-like concepts. But it calculates the green remediation, it calculates the green remediation metrics, but does not apply an impact assessment, which is certainly a required part of a full LCA. The materials and waste focus is on-site use and generation, not, for example, upstream footprints. Energy emissions and water also have fairly broad system boundaries. Another question we often get is, does the methodology consider economic and societal factors? And no, the methodology does not, this environmental footprint methodology does not. Existing regulatory requirements and initiatives such as the Community Engagement Initiative cover these topics, and we continue to strive to dovetail and coordinate with those other areas. Move to slide 15, please. At this point, Doug Sutton will start with the methodology overview. I'll hand it over to Doug. Doug?
Great. Thank you very much, Carlos. And the first thing I want to do is move on to slide 16, where we actually have some content. Materials, and what I want to do first is to go through some of the highlights of the methodology. And we'll talk about that in terms of the way, in the order that they're talked about in the document. So materials and waste highlights, then water highlights, and energy emission highlights. So when we talk about materials and waste highlights, the first thing I want to do is clarify what the metrics are when we talk about refined or manufactured materials and when we talk about bulk or unrefined materials. When we talk about the refined or manufactured ones, we're talking about something that goes through a manufacturing process like steel, treatment chemicals, PVC, HDPE, things like that. When we're talking about the unrefined or bulk materials, we're talking about things like soil, or sand and gravel or aggregate that is certainly used at the site but is not does not go through an extensive manufacturing process. We do not want to imply that the unrefined materials are the feedstock for the refined materials. The second thing is just to clarify that really what we're doing here is just a straightforward accounting of materials used on site and the waste that is generated on site, and then how much of that might be from recycled or reused materials, and how much of the waste, potential waste that was generated, might be able to be recycled or reused. And a lot of the methodology is simply providing tables to help organize that information, and also some rules of thumb or general assistance for helping convert what we're used to using in our feasibility studies, our designs, our O&M, our optimization documents, to convert that information into, you know, the metric values. For example, you know, it's nice to know that you have 10,000 two-inch pipe, PVC, 10,000 feet of 2-inch PVC pipe. It's another thing to convert that into pounds and to count that towards your materials usage. The document helps you do that. Moving on to slide number 17, talk about some of the highlights regarding the water. Straightforward accounting of on-site water use. We're talking about water that is actually used on-site, and we want to think about the source of the water that's used, the quantity that's used, how it's being used, and the fate of it after being used. And you can imagine why we would need to go through that level of, or apply those site-specific factors, because water is a very local resource, and its value or its usability depends on where it's coming from, what its quality is. And certainly when you use it, it has many different fates. It might be evaporated to the atmosphere, it might be discharged to surface water, it might be reinjected to the ground. It's important to note those factors. So we actually come up with almost site-specific metrics based on those factors associated with water use. Aquifer drawdown is caused by remedy pumping. So when we talk about that metric, we're talking about the drawdown of the aquifer such that it might affect local water use by impacting production well use, et cetera. When we're talking about off-site water use, we're really talking about just the quantity and not necessarily where it's being used, how it's being used, and the fate of it after it was used. And when we talk about off-site water, we're talking about the water that might be used in terms of electricity generation, materials manufacturing, or other types of off-site services like laboratory analysis. Certainly when it comes to those things, that's not necessarily a local water resource, and we can't necessarily determine exactly how all that water is being used and where it's going very easily. And again, much of this module is assistance in helping us, helping the user or the reader develop these water metrics based on site-specific information. Moving on to slide number 18, some of the energy and emissions highlights. It's a three-step process, basically going from inventorying the remedy materials and services, which we certainly can get from the materials and waste section, calculating the electricity and the fuel use, and then converting the electricity, fuel use, materials into energy and air metrics. We organize the results and the calculations into four different categories that are generally consistent with the Executive Order 13514. So when we look at on-site emissions or energy use, that would be associated with Scope 1. Electricity generation, for those of you familiar with that order and other forms of greenhouse gas inventories and might be familiar with this, but electricity would be electricity generation, that meaning the emissions associated with generating the electricity at the power plant, would be Scope 2. Transportation of materials or personnel to and from the site would be consistent with part of Scope 3 of the Executive Order definitions. And then other materials, other off-site activities such as materials manufacturing, waste disposal, laboratory analysis, things like that would also be part of Scope 3 or our fourth category. The methodology provides help in estimating and calculating these values and helps determine the appropriate level of detail to dive in, and then provides footprint conversion factors for everyone to use because that would save get us all on the same page and help the reader find those without doing extensive research. So with that in mind, I'd like to move to slide 19 and just talk about how the methodology is organized. It's organized in six different steps, and as Carlos mentioned, we'll focus on the first ones here and exclude the land and ecosystem for the time being. Step one is to gather remedy information. That's something that's typically readily available if you're in the design process or operating a remedy or even conducting optimization at a remedy. Step two is to estimate the materials and waste metrics based on that remedy information. And then estimating the water metrics. And then based on those two, the results of those two steps, you can then estimate the energy and emissions metrics. And the return to get the offsite water metric. And you come back to get that offsite water metric simply because you want that electricity usage and the and those other and the materials usage to help you calculate that offsite water metric. So now with some of this behind us and a little bit of an introduction to what we're doing, let's do an example application of the methodology. And so we'll move to slide number 20, and then which is just a break slide, and move on to slide number 21, which discusses the example application. So here we're going to consider a hypothetical pump and treat system that's designed to treat arsenic and operate for about 30 years. The treatment plant removes arsenic through co-precipitation, which some of you may recognize has intensive chemical usage and also substantial waste generation. So this is a little bit more involved than just say a pump and treat system that has an air stripper. The discharge of the treated water to a nearby creek. We're assuming that the local electricity generation mix is similar to that of California, and we're considering both the system construction and operation as part of this example. So moving on to slide number 22, which is just a break slide introducing step one, we can move on to slide number 23. And gathering the remedy information, on the left-hand side of this table, we just list typical things associated with a remedy, typical items or activities. And then in the right-hand column, we're talking about quantities or the data that we'd want to be able to take to the next step. So if you look on the left-hand column, you see the first entry is number, depth, and design of extraction wells. Well, it's helpful to know that we have 6-inch wells and maybe a total depth of 600 feet. Scanning down a little bit, helpful to know what the extraction rate is. Helpful to know what the dimensions of the treatment plant are. So just general remedy information such as this, and that's usually readily available from our other remedial documents. So moving on to step two, or the next slide, slide number 24, which is just an intro slide. And on to slide number 25, here we have a table that shows what it looks like when you start to categorize and itemize those various refined materials that are associated with the remedy. On the left-hand columns, there's two columns there that are in light blue, we talk about what the user of the methodology would provide. PVC and grout associated with wells, piping, building steel, concrete reinforcing steel, cement, portion of concrete, process equipment, and then you start to get into some treatment chemicals. And we're providing those in units that are common to what we're used to working with in our design or implementation documents, remedy documents. The middle two columns are show information that's provided by the methodology. Things like conversion factors to convert those maybe feet of piping, for example, into pounds of material. And the second of those medium colored blue columns is the percent of recycled material that the methodology would also provide you just to get a handle on what the typical typical recycled content is of those types of materials. And then the last two columns, these are calculated by the methodology, and I'm not suggesting that this is an actual tool that is doing this. I'm just showing that this is what the result would be of taking the information provided by the user and applying the factors that are provided in the methodology. You put those into a spreadsheet, and it would calculate these values off to the side. And we have where we're itemizing up the recycled materials in pounds and the virgin materials in pounds. And in the end, if you look down at the cells that are outlined in red, we see what the actual metric results are for this particular metric, the total amount of refined materials used, which in this case is over 15 million pounds over that 30-year period, including construction, and the about 2% of it comes from recycled content. Now, you can see that there's a lot of numbers here. Some of them might be helpful. This is the raw data, and you might want to jump in and start saying, okay, well, what can we reduce? What's the most effective thing to start focusing on? And that's a great question to ask, but what I want to focus on now is just deriving these numbers, show how you derive these numbers, and then let Karen and Kira talk about approaches to footprint reduction during their section. So if we move on to slide number 26, we're going through the same sort of process here for the unrefined materials. And here where we have the sand pack from the wells, and we have the aggregate portion of the concrete. You can see that we've split up concrete into a refined material, which is the cement portion of it, which actually does have a significant manufacturing component to it, and the aggregate for the concrete. And in this case, it's organized the same way with the left two columns being provided by the user in kind of typical format that you'd expect from a remedial document. Middle two columns are provided by the methodology, and the last two columns are calculated, and down at the bottom, the red outline cells provide some of the values, or provide your metric results that you would be able to analyze down the road for footprint reduction. Moving on to the next slide, which is slide number 27. Same sort of accounting for waste. This is all very straightforward, just counting up the amount of waste that is associated with the site. And in this case, all of it that we determined was significant is the dewatered metals precipitated sludge, which came out to about 7,800 tons. And it was a listed hazardous waste, so it's counted here as hazardous waste, and none of the waste associated with the site was able to be recycled or reused in this particular example. So moving on to slide number 28, we are going to shift gears into the water metrics. And on slide 29, we provide a table that outlines how the water metric might be calculated or might be displayed. On the left-hand side, we have we've divided things into the on-site water resources, the on-site footprint, and the off-site footprint. So the upper portion of the tables for the on-site footprint. In our left-hand column, we have public water supply. And you can see the description of the quality of water used is potable. And the volume that we use, which is 360,000, the units are in thousands, so it's 360 million gallons of potable water for polymer blending. And the theta of that is to be blended with the treatment process water and eventually discharged to the creek. So no longer that same quality of water. The second row would be the extracted groundwater. And we have, the user would enter that's the shallow groundwater. They might even provide an aquifer name. It's of marginal quality, meaning maybe it's high in iron or total dissolved solids, such that it's maybe not drinking water quality. Note the amount of the amount that's used, in this case extracted, the uses treatment, and the fate of it is discharged to the creek. Now, providing that information to a stakeholder that might be interested in the water footprint helps them understand that, you know, maybe you're using a lot of this shallow groundwater, and how are you using it, and where, what its fate is. You can see down at the bottom that the completed that the offsite water use is completed after we go through the energy and emissions. But I want to, if we move to the next slide, slide number 30, you can contrast this previous slide with this one, and you look on that second row that I just have highlighted for in light green. The extracted groundwater in this case, just shifting the example of it, might be from the, at another site, might be from the Ogallala Aquifer. In this case, it's a vital aquifer to the region, both for irrigation and drinking water. Just because we're using the same example, that would be the same volume of groundwater that's extracted and treated. And if we're actually discharged to the creek, well, you start to put into this picture that, okay, we're extracting 11 billion gallons of water from the Ogallala Aquifer and discharging it to a creek where it no longer has that same beneficial use. And once again, I highlight that the off-site water use is completed as step five. And there's other sections here where, you know, people are using, if remedies are using surface water, reclaimed water, collected or diverted storm water, things like that. And we also have, there's nothing that would keep anybody from adding in multiple rows for if there's different sources of groundwater to use, say shallow aquifer versus deep aquifer. Moving on to slide 31, rather, we're going to shift gears now to estimating the energy and emissions metrics. And slide 32 has some content. The first step, as I mentioned before, was to conduct an inventory of the information regarding the site. Things like equipment operation, which is maybe in this case drill rig operation for installing wells, electrical equipment for operating the process equipment. We go down and we see items for transportation, both for personnel and for materials, empty return trips for trucks, all the different types of materials that we're using, and some of the off-site services that we're using. So this stuff is typically readily available in remedial documents, and if they're not readily available, it's usually not too hard to find that information. So that's step one of the energy and emissions section. The next thing to do is to figure out our electricity, our natural gas, our fuel usage. So we're converting our electrical equipment into electricity usage and natural gas equipment, such as, say, a boiler or a furnace, into natural gas usage.
The number you have dialed is not in service.
And then transportation equipment usage would be converted into fuel. And if we look down in some of these, we just carried through some of the calculations here for display purposes. But if we were to sum up the electrical use for the treatment processes, for the extraction pumps, and for the electrical use for lighting and the HVAC of the building, you add up to about 39 million kilowatt hours over the course of the 30-year remedy. You can also see the amounts of diesel or gasoline or natural gas used for these other components. Moving on to slide number 34, this would be the last part of the energy and emissions section, and it's to take things like electricity, fuel combustion, materials, et cetera, multiplying them by their respective conversion factors for the parameter that you're after. In this case, we're just displaying the carbon dioxide equivalents for greenhouse gas emissions. But you do the same thing for energy, for, maybe you measure that in millions of BTUs, criteria pollutants such as your NOx, SOx, and PM, and your hazardous air pollutants. Moving on to slide number 35. A table that just shows how things are calculated and summed up for the various categories we mentioned earlier, on-site, electricity generation, transportation, and off-site. And then the total at the bottom and the total at the bottom are those are examples of two of the metrics we're after, the energy and the greenhouse gas. Of course, we'd also have entries for criteria pollutants and HAPs that we don't show just for display purposes. But by organizing the information in this manner, you can also see where your big contributors are and where your big contributors are not. So, and that would be critical for looking at the steps that Karen and Kira are going to talk about. So moving on to slide number 36, go back to the off-site water metric. Now that we have our electricity generation, and we can now fill in that part of that table that was blank earlier, We have our electricity generation, our materials production, and you can now use that to calculate the water usage. And that would be step 5. And then step 38, this is a summary of what your environmental footprint might look like, the various metrics on the in the left-hand column, and the values of those metrics on the right-hand column. And then a couple bullets here or bubbles that I have as a reminder, what does this all mean, and what do I do with it? And that gives me a transition back to other speakers, and I think, Carlos, I should give it back to you if you're interested in addressing questions.
Thank you, Doug. We have if anybody on the phone lines has a question, a clarification question, please let us know. Let me first take one from the Internet, and we've got a lot of this internally as well. Regarding the sourcing information, the question is from our colleague in Region 2, Dale Carpenter. What source of information are you using 4% recycled or reused content? I guess this would be for Doug.
Yeah, those sources vary. We're trying to find generic numbers that are that generally apply. So some of those are coming from relevant associations, but it, certainly if you have some specific ones in mind and would like to contribute those, we'd be interested in hearing about them.
Any clarification questions from the phone lines?
Hey, Carlos, this is Paul Favara. I got a question for Doug as far as the quantification of the materials that are used in the estimate. When you'd said that the soil and the gravel weren't being represented as feedstocks, did that mean that when you have something like steel or something like that, that your footprint for steel doesn't include those materials and it doesn't go all the way back to the cradle?
The footprint for the steel, would be, let's say we used a pound of steel associated with a steel pipe, just as an example. Now, when we look at our carbon dioxide or our NOx and SOx footprints, all those sort of things, that's sort of a cradle to gate type thing. You're going to get the life cycle of that. But when we're talking about the materials, for the purpose of this methodology, we're just talking about that 1 pound of steel. So if you were to add up your materials footprint for refined materials, and that was the only thing you used, your footprint would be 1 pound of steel. We're not going back and saying what's the iron ore or whatever else that went into that. We're just looking at the materials that are actually being used at the site. So that would be very different from a life cycle assessment where your system boundaries were very expanded for the materials section. And part of the reason for that is that I really want to focus on, I think part of the effort of focusing on footprint reduction is going after reducing materials, direct materials usage, aiming for materials from recycled content, and those sort of things. It wasn't to provide the whole life cycle materials usage for the remedy.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
If I could just ask one quick follow-up. So if you take a look at the steel example, what is the boundary or the upstream boundary of the steel for this example?
The upstream boundary, for this particular number, we referenced the Europa database, and we referenced the National Renewable Energy Laboratory database. And I believe the numbers that we're currently using are from the Europa database, and those are fairly decently far back. Those go through the mining process for the ore, for example.
Okay.
An extensive upstream boundary.
All right.
For calculating things like the off-site water use or the energy and emissions, but not for calculating all the materials that are used. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thanks, Doug.
Thank you, Paul. Any other clarification?
Hi, we have a question here from CDM, if we might. This is Mike Miller. In discussing the building up of your inventory, the materials used is all quantified as a total at the end of the presentation there, the sub-presentation as pounds of total materials. And what we're concerned about is the appearance that denser materials are going to be counted more heavily than lighter materials. So as an example, steel versus activated carbon.
You're correct. It would.
Does that make sense to count denser materials more heavily than lighter materials?
Well, I think if you were to if you were to be concerned about disposal, I can start to see where you'd be more concerned about that. But does it? I mean, if we were to look at volume, would that be a different factor? I mean, when you look at things like the environmental impact, say of you know, the emissions that come off of some of these materials, for example, a lot of them are more closely tied to the actual mass of it than to the volume of it. So, it's certainly a question I'd like to entertain. I mean, I think measuring in terms of pounds is certainly satisfactory. I'm not personally concerned about the you know, a denser material versus a lighter material, and concerned more about the volume than the mass. I tend to think that the mass makes more sense, but if somebody has a countering to that, I'd like to hear it.
Yeah, that's a good question, and we'll definitely look at it. One of the criteria for selecting the parameters we selected here is to identify areas or pieces of information that we can take action on. And the volume question is a good one. It's closely related to transportation and other factors or footprint components. But appreciate the question, and we'll certainly take another look at that. Any other clarification questions on the phone lines? Then I'd like to get through the material, so if it's okay. And remember that at any point in time, you can click on the question mark button on your screens, and we'll be able to take those as they come in during the discussion session. So with that, Karen, if you're available, I'd like to hand it back to you for key considerations on interpreting the results.
All right. Thanks, Carlos. So let's move to slide 39. And now Doug showed in his final slide the results from the footprint analysis for the example case study, showing a lot of numbers. And he brought up the question of how should we interpret those results. And that's what I'll be talking about here, key considerations for interpreting the results of a footprint analysis. And what I'm going to do is point out considerations to take into account not only after the analysis is completed, but also things to think about before and during the footprint analysis, because these are all interrelated. So let's move to slide 40. Questions to ask before doing the footprint analysis. So the methodology will help you think through some of these questions. For example, what will the results be used for? This is important to think about before you begin, because you may set up the analysis differently depending on the questions that you're trying to answer. For example, if you're interested in improving a remedy designed to reduce the footprint, of course, you'll want to set up the analysis to evaluate various remedy designs. But if you're interested in tracking footprint reductions gained from applying BMPs or best management practices to an existing remedy, you'll want to set up the analysis to establish a baseline and then to document improvements. Another question is, what parameters are of the greatest importance? Now, the methodology recommends that a variety of parameters be evaluated, but some may be more relevant to your site or may be of greater importance to your stakeholders. So you may put more information into those metrics for greater accuracy and completeness. So that's an important question to ask before you begin. And then, what are the likely sources of information that you'll have at hand for conducting your footprint analysis? Of course, depending on what stage of the remedy design or implementation your site is at, the information you have at hand may be of greater or lesser reliability. Being aware of this beforehand is important. It can help you determine whether more effort should be made in gathering information, and it also can help you set expectations for the accuracy of the results. So thinking over these topics before beginning your footprint analysis will help you to be sure that the scope and approach of the footprint analysis suits the intended use, and it'll also help you to prepare for applying the results. So moving on to slide 41. This is questions to ask during the footprint analysis. As you get underway with the footprint analysis, you will continue to refine your approach. And one question to ask is, what activities or materials can be omitted from the analysis? Carlos was talking about how we really want to go for the larger contributors to the environmental footprint from the cleanup. So, for example, during your footprint analysis, as you're running through the numbers, you will notice materials used in small amounts and activities occurring at infrequent intervals, and you may identify these to be minimal contributors to the footprint, and you may be able to omit these from the formal analysis. Another question to ask is, what are the sources of error or uncertainty? For example, at a preliminary design stage, your remedy may have 10 injection wells, but you may be aware that in the final design, there could be a lot more wells than that you actually design for the remedy. And you may also identify other sources of uncertainty, such as remedy timeframes or footprint conversion factors. As the footprint analysis progresses, you'll want to address these types of uncertainties, for example, by evaluating alternative remedy designs, performing sensitivity analyses, or conducting additional research. And the methodology will help you work through these types of questions. The key message here is that you should document the sources of uncertainty as you proceed with a footprint analysis, and you should document how they're addressed. So moving on to slide 42. These are questions to ask after the analysis has been completed. And these questions pertain to understanding, interpreting, and applying the results from the footprint analysis. So you'll want to ask things like, how accurate are the results? What is a big footprint? What parameters are of greatest importance? And can I use the results to target areas for improvement? And I'll touch on each of these questions in the next four slides. And just so nobody is left in suspense, the answer to the last question there, can I use the results to target areas for improvement? The answer to that, of course, is yes. Slide 43. So starting out with how accurate are the results. So during the footprint analysis, as I mentioned, you will have documented sources of uncertainty. And so you can keep this in mind as you interpret the results. This slide points out potential areas of uncertainty arising from our case study. And for example, the pump and treat remedy in the case study was expected to continue for 30 years. If this is only an approximate time frame, we would have identified this during the analysis, and we would know to interpret the results accordingly. The bottom line is, when interpreting and applying the results of a footprint analysis, keep in mind that the results of the analysis are estimates to help guide future footprint reductions and are not exact numbers. Slide 44. So what about this? What is a big footprint? In our case study, we estimated the greenhouse gas emissions at about 80 million pounds. And the on-site water usage at about 360 million gallons, and we estimated that there would be about 8,000 tons of hazardous waste generated, just to name a few of the metrics. Now, these numbers may sound big, but what is a good benchmark for comparison? How do we know whether these are too big, in quotes, and should be reduced? So, of course, there are no universal benchmarks for the footprints from our site cleanup saying what's big and what's not big. And, of course, our perception of big or a big footprint or a small footprint may be dependent on the size of the site and the effort required for the cleanup. However, there's a couple things you can think about. For example, how the footprint from a particular remedy compares with footprints of similar remedies in your organization's portfolio, or how it compares with your organization's overall footprint. There also may be goals that your organization has set for footprint reductions. So, of course, we should keep in mind that even a small percentage reduction of the footprint from a site cleanup may translate to a large reduction in magnitude, and we should try to make those reductions wherever it seems to make sense. Slide 45. So what parameters are of the greatest importance? As you saw, the methodology recommends an array of metrics, in four of EPA's core elements of green remediation. But once you see the results of a footprint analysis, like that last slide that Doug had in his part of the presentation, how can you tell which of the parameters are of the greatest importance? And, of course, this will depend on conditions specific to the site and on values important to site stakeholders. So, for example, in our case study, if our site is in a region of non-attainment for particulates, then particulate emissions may be of greatest concern to the stakeholders. Also, greenhouse gas emissions could be important to a municipality with greenhouse gas reduction goals, and the water footprint would be important to a site in arid lands. And another example, waste generation may be important for a community that has concerns about available landfill space. So we should be aware also that there may be trade-offs among the various metrics in our footprint analysis. Slide 46. So finishing up with this slide, again, we use the results of a footprint analysis to target areas for improvement. The answer is yes. Footprint analysis can provide results in a format like this that highlights key contributors. This chart shows the estimated greenhouse gas emissions from all the activities and materials required for the remedy that Doug showed in the case study. Now, often in footprint reduction efforts, we focus our efforts on reducing the usage of gasoline and diesel and electricity. And, of course, this is always a good idea, but in many cases, such as the one illustrated here, there may be other activities that make substantial contributions to the footprint. And in this case, it's the footprint for CO2 emissions. Here, electricity generation is the largest contributor, but we can also see that there are other relatively significant contributors, such as natural gas usage, and that's for heating the buildings associated with the remedy, and production of chemical reagents, such as hydrogen peroxide and sodium hydroxide. Of course, key contributors to the footprint will be different for each new site and each new remedy technology. So, for example, at other sites, we've seen other key contributors, such as production of bioremediation nutrients and zero-valent iron as key contributors to the footprint, as well as seeing off-site activities such as wastewater treatment, laboratory analysis, and regeneration of granular activated carbon. So to wrap up, this chart demonstrates one of the primary benefits of conducting a footprint analysis, that is, targeting areas for footprint reduction. And the methodology that we're presenting today can be used to develop charts like this. So that wraps up my portion of the presentation, and this can serve as a lead-in to our next speaker, Kira, who will talk about applying the results of a footprint analysis, although I think I need to turn it back over to Carlos first at this point.
Thanks, Karen. That was great. Your topic and what Kira is going to present are very closely related. We do have a good batch of Internet questions, but if it's okay with folks, I'm going to hold the questions so you guys can continue, so Kira can continue on what you've discussed. Kira?
Thanks, Carlos. So going from slide number 47 to slide number 48, basically we wanted to reemphasize the main use of the footprint analysis is to really help us with looking at options for reducing the footprint. We're not promoting using the footprint analysis as output to justify selecting a specific remedy over another, but rather as a way to optimize any selected remedy. So going on to slide number 49, looking at the footprint reduction is really consistent with good science and engineering and all the other aspects of optimization that we're trying to do on our environmental projects. So, for example, it's very consistent with making sure that we have an accurate conceptual site model and we're understanding, for example, where the soil that is really contaminated in a dig and haul site that has to be moved off site, reducing our uncertainty with making false positive decisions and removing soil and disposing of it when it's not really contaminated is consistent with looking at trying to reduce the environmental impacts of digging out that material and disposing of it in a landfill facility where it's not needed. It's also consistent with sound engineering. So for, as an example on that, looking at a pump and treat system and really understanding what the optimal extraction rate needs to be and what's going to be the most efficient pump to achieve that is basically sound engineering, as well as a component of looking at how are we going to reduce the overall environmental footprint of a remedy that we're applying. So going on to slide number 50, this is just kind of a holistic view of how we see the footprint reduction playing into the remedy optimization process. So we really have to look at the selected alternatives and how we're applying those remedies, and through that, we can identify and look at big contributors to the environmental footprint and look at ways that we can maybe reduce that. We also are promoting the use of looking at best management practices along with the site-specific big contributors. So, for example, if you're looking at a dig-and-haul project, there's many kind of simple best management practices, like requiring construction equipment with no idling periods, using alternative fuels, those types of things that are just kind of standard best management practices that people are capturing that can be applied. So once you consider those two pieces, the final piece that can help you optimize the footprint reduction is to also look at, you know, is there a way that we can apply renewable energy into this equation to reduce that footprint even further. So going on to slide number 51, this is just kind of an example that that is an example of the concept that I was just talking about. In this particular case, in version one, we had a site that we were looking at that originally they're using air stripping to treat volatile organics. It was, the air stripping output was then going into granular activated carbon system before being discharged to the sanitary sewer. So one of the things that in the optimization was looked at was to look at enhancing the air stripping and eliminating the carbon extraction. So in the second version, we were still discharging to the sanitary sewer, but we were able to enhance the air stripping to a point where we didn't feel that you needed to go through the secondary treatment in the carbon in order to achieve the levels to allow it to go to the sanitary sewer. And then in number three, this is with a further optimization of looking at, okay, if I really up the throughput on the air stripper and I eliminate the carbon, could I reduce those VOC concentrations far enough down so I wouldn't have to even go into the sanitary sewer anymore, and I could discharge directly to surface water? And you can see that reduces the environmental footprint even further. And then the final look at the footprint was the version four, and what you're looking at here is the environmental footprint associated with doing all of those things, like optimizing the air stripping, getting rid of the carbon and the discharge to the sanitary sewer, but then also applying renewable energy to run that air stripper. So this is just an example of one type of system where you can go through that multi-step process to look at how, if you change the particular remedy, how that might also not only optimize the treatment, but also optimize the reduction of your footprint. So going on to slide number 52, This is another example of that same type of analysis for a bioremediation remedy. So in the first version, what we're looking at there is we're looking at a baseline injection of emulsified vegetable oil and using potable water. So you can see here we're looking at two footprint parameters, one being CO2 and the other being water use. So in that case, we have the highest footprint for both the CO2 and the water use. If you look at the next example, that's looking at just injection of the emulsified vegetable oil, but using extracted water. So in this case, you still have basically the same CO2 footprint, but you have reduced the water input almost entirely. The third example is the use of biodiesel for materials transport and the drill rig operation, which basically just has a slight reduction in the CO2. The fourth version is use of off-spec or waste food-grade product for the bioremediation nutrient. And you can see here that that has a huge impact on the CO2 reduction, and I think that's something that we found in many of these enhanced bioremediation projects, that if you can use an off-spec product, which would otherwise be something that would be disposed of as your nutrient, as opposed to using a material like a emulsified vegetable oil, you can really reduce the overall environmental footprint of your project, as well as, in many cases, optimize and reduce the cost. Then for version number 5, this is just an example of this idea of refining your conceptual site model and being able to reduce the area over which you really need to do the injections. And by doing that, you could potentially reduce the environmental footprint for all parameters in half if you basically, as an example, better understood your conceptual model and reduced the area that you needed to treat by half. And then number 6 is looking at refining the CSM as well as using an off-spec product for nutrient. So you can see there that basically you're reducing your environmental footprint for both the CO2 and the water significantly. And then finally, the last example is kind of using all of these components together, which would be making sure that you've refined your conceptual model, you're using the off-spec product, you're using extracted groundwater instead of potable water for mixing, and then that you've got the use of biodiesel. And in this case, you've been able to basically reduce your environmental footprint for the water completely and significantly reduce the CO2 footprint. So going on to slide number 53, so we're just going to talk a little bit here back at the example that Doug had gone through on the pump and treat. So what are the things that you do when you start interpreting the results? Well, you want to go through and you want to look at really what are the big contributors and what are the particular like footprint parameters that they're impacting. And what are the primary contributors that the various pieces are playing into? So going on to slide number 54, this is just kind of a flow diagram that talks about the pump and treat example that Doug had gone through. So we have electricity, and some of the big things that were feeding into that were both the extraction rate and the HVAC system on the treatment building, and those things were being controlled by the pump and mixer motors. You also had the materials that was primarily tied to the chemicals that were being used for treatment, which is being influenced by the influent loading. You also had the materials, the concrete associated with the actual treatment plant itself. And then we've got the waste piece, which was primarily being driven by the precipitated solids from the water treatment, which then was linked to the influent loading for the treatment system, as well as the hazardous waste listing of that material. So going on to slide number 55, so the next question you want to ask yourself is, what are options for addressing the big contributors, the things that may be associated with the conceptual site model? In this particular example, could we optimize the extraction rate and as a result then, for example, have an influence on the materials being used? Or could we do some sort of source removal or stabilization to reduce the influent concentrations, which then could also reduce the waste component by potentially limiting the amount of precipitated solids that were being produced? You can also look at process optimization options. So are there changes or substitutes to the process components that could be used, like different electricity or chemical use? You could also look at whether the pumps are properly sized and whether there's options for variable frequency drives or other things that could reduce that energy use. So going on to slide number 56. So some of the other things that we can be doing to address some of these big contributors is look at traditional energy efficiency options. So is there a way to adjust the HVAC or the lighting operation? Are there ways to use more efficient lighting technologies such as LED? As far as managing the waste, in this example that we had from Doug, they were using chemical precipitation, and we could look at whether there was other chemicals that could be used that would not have the same significant waste stream as that. And then finally, as we said before, there's many options for looking at kind of best management practices and also looking at options for applying renewable energy. There's many treatment plants now that are looking at options such as solar panels or other things that are alternative options for actually running the treatment plant itself. So going on to slide number 57, we've done a lot of talk about kind of the process of going through and finding the big contributors and trying to look at ways to reduce those big contributors. But in no way does that mean that we're saying that we shouldn't also be considering kind of the other maybe smaller contributors to the overall environmental footprint, like transportation. So, for example, many times there are smaller contributors that can be reduced just through simple best management practices, and we're definitely encouraging the use of looking at best management practices for all aspects of the projects that we do, because all of those small reductions can also add up to the overall environmental footprint. So that's the end of my session. I think I'm turning it back over to you now, Carlos.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Kira. And before we go on to next steps, I think it'd be good to take a lot of the questions that relate to the past three speakers. So I'll go ahead and start taking some questions on the Internet. If the folks on the phone lines want to gear up, that would be good. There's a question from T3W in San Diego. The question is, the water metrics looked at water use, but did not seem to address impacts of water discharge. Would the impact on site hydrology and in-stream ecology, et cetera, be addressed in the ecosystem metrics yet to be developed? So, Doug, I'd like to ask you to address that, since that is indeed an area we're still working on.
Well, certainly the commenter is correct that the way the water metric is thus far does not account for those ecological effects or the site hydrology, other than maybe to consider the drawdown on a water table, for example. When you start to take into account those other factors, those are potential things that are being considered for the land and ecosystems module, to the degree that they are things that occur during the course of a remedy. Carlos,
okay.
I don't know if you'd like to follow up with that further.
Another question related to water. How is the difference between use of shallow groundwater of marginal quality and something like the Ogallala Aquifer water quantified in this methodology? I think you touched on that, Doug, but maybe expand.
Yeah, I think
a little
I can expand on that. I think the example that I provided probably didn't expand on that as much as it probably could. Now, these metrics aren't necessarily meant to compare one site to another. So, for example, if we had one site that was extracting and treating and discharging water of marginal quality and another one was extracting water from Ogallala Aquifer, we wouldn't necessarily be, you know, using that same metric back and forth to compare the two of them. But I think a better example would be, let's take a look at a site that has a shallow aquifer with contamination that is of marginal quality, maybe like a high, you know, high toll dissolved solids, but it has contamination. But also look at an underlying, say, confined aquifer, where water is also being extracted. And the water in the confined aquifer is of good quality, maybe like the English Town, aquifer in New Jersey or something like that nature. So in that case, at the particular site, you have, maybe extraction and treatment of two different water sources. You know, I think that's the point where you'd like to be able to show, here we're extracting, treating, and discharging this much water of marginal quality, and we're extracting, treating, and discharging this much of water from this particular vital aquifer. So you're able to provide both of those. Maybe on the table or SMR is the footprint, there might be one row for the shallow aquifer and one row for the other aquifer.
Okay. And one more from the Internet. I guess this one might be for Kira. Slide 52. This is from Brooke Bonkowski in Arcadis, Portland, Oregon. Slide 52, aren't many of these versions really going toward remedy selection, such as version 6 off-spec product or version 5, where you've refined the conceptual model to reduce the remedy area?
I think that's more of an issue of a confusion about terminology, because when we're talking about reducing the environmental footprint, for example, by using off-spec products, normally if you're going to select in-situ bio remedy for a project, you don't specify at the time what the carbon source is going to be, and that's something that's usually left to engineering design where you can optimize and look at the various options of what you're applying. So at least from this perspective of EPA, we don't really look at the selection of the nutrient source for an enhanced bioremediation project as part of the remedy selection, but rather as optimizing an in-situ bio remedy that has been selected. As far as the piece about refining the conceptual site model, when we're talking about refining the conceptual site model, we're really talking about that being something that gets applied during the characterization phase of a project before you've done remedy selection, where you're really looking at optimizing and understanding where your source area is so that you're doing good science and you're applying the technologies to the area of the site where they're needed. So we're talking about that from the aspect of really making sure that our characterization is done thoroughly enough to make sure that we've selected remedies and are applying them in a way that makes sense and that is protective.
Thanks, Kira. Okay, folks on the phone lines, if you have questions, please share them with us.
Hi, this is Steve Linder at EPA Region 9. I have a question about policy and the calculations you're doing. Do you at all consider, an overall lower magnitude footprint, but basically a higher short-term magnitude, such as an excavation, versus a larger overall magnitude footprint, but over a much larger period of time, say like an in-situ technology? How would you weigh those two different options or those two different approaches in your evaluation process?
I think this evaluation process, what it does is it produces a methodology for quantifying those environmental footprints. I think the question you're asking is, how is that information incorporated into the remedy selection process? in this, and I'll speak from the Superfund perspective at least, and I mean, there's we're working on some clarification on that, but basically it is within the existing nine criteria. So the question is more a matter of how is the information generated through this process, which you didn't ask whether or not it would apply to either one of those two projects, and I believe it would, but how would that information be used? So I think that's more the question that would be asked in that case, and please let me know if I'm wrong.
Well, I guess I'm coming from a different program outside of the Superfund program,
okay.
U.S. program, and, you know, a lot of, you know, we look at remedies and approaches to cleanups, and sometimes it may make more sense to go in and dig the contamination up, but there's a short-term spike in basically carbon footprint during that process, things like diesel emissions. Some of these longer-term processes may actually have an overall higher carbon footprint, but the short-term magnitude is much, much lower. So when we're going in and looking at, you know, what is the how we would modify an ongoing cleanup, should we go in and do some excavation or shouldn't we? I guess that's kind of my question. How would we evaluate short-term versus long-term?
Yeah, that's a valid question. I hope we can address it in the subsequent.
Carlos, it is a valid question. It is something that we actually have considered, but it adds another layer of complexity to an already relatively complex process. So certainly perspectives on that are welcome because it is something that we've definitely toyed with. It's almost for example, the time value of carbon, or if you want to put it that way, or of NOx or SOx emissions. And it's, believe me, it is something that we looked at. It's just a matter of how do we add that in there without adding a lot more layers of complexity, and does it provide information that we actually want people to consider, so.
Right, and this is an incremental process. I guess our first step is to let's reach an agreement on, you know, across programs in EPA and with others on how we quantify footprint, and then we'll decide, then we'll work on how that information is used across the different programs or within different programs. So thanks for the question, Steve. Other questions?
Carlos, this is John Ryan with ACOM. I'm wondering, is footprint reduction going to become a requirement for remedy implementation on CERCLA projects?
I don't see that happening. But within fund lead sites, it certainly is going to be an objective.
Thanks.
Other phone questions, please?
Yeah, Carlos. This is John Pagurski from Region 1.
Hi, John.
I guess the issue of uncertainty kind of weighs in my mind, because that's really going to be pretty important in trying to, when you sort of compare different values that you're calculating or estimating. So one question there is, when you use these generic conversion factors, do those specify or at least approximate the uncertainty associated with those numbers? And I guess the second half of the question is, are you guys going to at some point provide some guidance as to how an RPM might go through an uncertainty analysis?
Okay, thanks, John. Karen, you could address that part on the uncertainty component?
Yes, sure. Some of our numbers do have pretty well documented degrees of uncertainty. This kind of gets back to the life cycle inventory databases that Doug was mentioning. Some of them do, in fact, document or give you an idea at least of how reliable those conversion factors are. And then some of the conversion factors that we've developed on our own, although I don't know that we've explicitly quantified the level of uncertainty, that's probably something that we should think about doing and documenting clearly. But it is a really important concern that, an important thing that as you interpret the results, you should be aware of. So obviously, if one of your conversion factors you know is plus or minus, let's say, 100%, like it could be twice as much as what you're using, twice as large as what you're using, you just kind of either have to mentally follow that through to the end and know what that means for whatever kind of optimizations or improvements you're considering, or as I was kind of alluding to in my part of the presentation, you really should formally document how those may play out so that you're aware of them as you're looking at the final numbers.
Great, thanks. And, of course, how comfortable we are with the uncertainty also depends on what the cost of being wrong is. So if we're looking at a significant cost or possibly mitigation measure, we want to have the greatest certainty possible on what we're going to get by implementing that measure.
All right. This is Doug speaking. I just want to add as well that if you're applying the footprint approach, say, relatively early in the design phase or during optimization where you're looking at some fairly significant modifications to the remedy, there may be a decent amount of uncertainty in your design parameters as well.
So I brought up the cost. We do have a question here from Robert Kelly from Ecovac Services in Woodstock, Georgia. It's a short question, but an important one. Is cost totally ignored in this process? So I'll leave it open and see which one of you wants to take it. Otherwise, I'll do it.
This is Karen Sherman, and when the question says, is it ignored in this process, it's not considered in the methodology itself. We're not suggesting or laying out ways to estimate cost or compare cost among different remedy designs or anything like that. So, no, this methodology does not address cost.
I think the important thing to point out, though, is that in many EPA programs, especially in Superfund, we already have a mechanism for addressing cost, and it's one of the 9 criteria. So we're not this is a step above and beyond what we're already going through in our standard process to look at remedy selection.
Okay, we have any other questions from the phone lines?
Hey, Carlos, this is Paul Favar again. I just wanted to add to the comments on cost is that, while the evaluations that we've been through today don't address cost, that there's generally, better than a 90% plus correlation that if you're reducing the footprint of the project, you're also going to be reducing the cost because you're using less resources.
Yeah, that's a good point. I guess another way of looking at it is the purpose of this methodology is to determine what you want to reduce. A second step would be to see what options you have to achieve those reductions. So, indeed, it doesn't directly address cost. It provides information on what we want to address, and then the next step would be to evaluate footprint reduction options, some of which have been discussed, like optimization or using alternative energy sources, et cetera. Okay, any other questions from the phone lines?
Hi, Carlos. This is Barbara Mako in Region 9. Kudos to you and your team of presenters there. I thought that was a great presentation.
Thank you.
I really like the visuals on the results of your life cycle analysis approach, for the pump and tree. Now, there are other life cycle analysis approaches out there. Will the methodology be able to help RPMs visually show the differences between those life cycle analysis approaches?
Good question. We're going to partially address that, and maybe Hillary, maybe you can take note of that question. We're going to talk about that a little bit in next steps. So if that's okay, we'll because there are related questions, and I prefer to hold those if that's okay. So
okay,
Hillary,
thanks.
Please take note. Sure. Here's a broad question from Steve Anacone and Altus Environmental in Boulder. Does the recognition and quantification of environmental footprints make regulators consider the need or extent for cleanups when little or no risk are present? So I'll leave that open, and then I'll take it.
I can take a stab at that, Carlos. From the standpoint of a Superfund perspective, at least, the looking at trying to reduce our environmental footprint is something that's being done in addition to our standard process. And our standard process has very clear guidelines for going through and working with responsible parties and the public to identify sites that are actionable and what is an actionable risk versus not an actionable risk. So I don't see any of the work that we're doing on trying to reduce our environmental footprints on our projects, which is being good environmental stewards and applying good science, impacting our process that we already have documented through our regulatory requirements on making determinations of when we take an action at a site and when we don't.
Thanks, Kira. And I'm scanning Drew here to see if there are questions particularly related to, you know, technical questions related to case studies or the methodology. I'll try to skin these out, find these. So a question here from Marion Weber and AMEC in Portland, Maine. Question is, so the materials do not contribute to energy or CO2? And I guess this goes, we kind of touched on this earlier. Doug, if you want to, or Karen, you want to address that, I'd appreciate it.
This is Doug. Yeah, the materials do contribute to the energy and emissions footprints. If we go to, if I were to go back to slide, it was one of my sum up slides, slide number 35, you'll see that, for example, the off-site portion of the CO2 metric was over 31 million pounds of CO2. Carbon dioxide equivalents, and 18 million of that came from, or a decent portion of that came from materials. So it doesn't specify on that sheet that it came from, that it, what portion came from materials, but materials is definitely listed as one of the components of that. So yes, materials are considered in the energy usage and emissions footprints.
Great. We have another question here, a comment from Rick Weiss in TouchTech in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Kira gave us some really good case studies, i.e. pump and treat and bio. It would be really useful and great selling point to show cost trade-offs of footprint reduction and optimization. I'm going to hand it to Kira, but first I want to remind everybody that on the kluin.org/green remediation page, we do have quite a few case studies on best practices and results achieved, but the cost information is a recurring one. We haven't found it to be that significantly different, or it's provided a cost reduction implementing the best practice, but we agree we have to do a better job of documenting that so people know what those costs may be. But Kira, anything you want to mention there?
I think the main thing is that we're in agreement, and I think that, you know, from EPA's perspective, that we are working on a parallel initiative to look at a national optimization for all of our projects throughout the life cycle of project implementation. And one of the components that we as an agency are bringing into those optimization reviews is this step to look at environmental footprint reduction specifically as one of the pieces that are considered in that optimization process. So I think we agree that this is something we don't necessarily have a lot of the information on projects documented, but hopefully as we move forward with this other initiative, we'll be able to identify and document those things.
Thank you. Questions from the phone lines, please.
Hey, this is Russell Adrian from Battelle. I was wondering, is EPA giving any consideration for going to the next level and considering the impact assessment?
Carlos, right, I can take that if you like.
Thank you, Karen.
So we haven't discussed that formally here at EPA, but it's something that is in the back of our minds, some of us anyway, that the impact assessment step, which in a formal life cycle assessment would be the next step after what we've done here, that is here in our methodology where we're looking at metrics, such as pounds of emissions, contaminants, and air emissions. And that is the inventory analysis. And in life cycle assessment terms, that would be an inventory analysis. And then next step, as you know, would be the impact assessment. And the methodology does not take that next step into the impact assessment. And there are a couple of things that we're keeping in mind as we think about that question. And one thing is just the degree of complexity and extra effort that would be required to do a full life cycle assessment. And I think that that's something that we could do at certain sites that are perhaps very large and complex and have a lot of stuff going on, that perhaps we might do a full life cycle assessment at those sites. And if we were, we would do that using probably some sort of commercially available life cycle assessment software. So it's not that this methodology precludes anybody or any of us at EPA doing a full life cycle assessment. It's just that this methodology is a somewhat simpler approach than a full life cycle assessment, and we think it will be very useful at most of our sites where just the emissions themselves and the water usage and the waste generation and the materials usage are the main key metrics that will be of use to our site managers. So, again, it's kind of an open question for us. It may be somewhere that we go in the future, but that we're not going there right now.
Thanks, Karen. Another one here related to the methodology itself. Question from Kendra Morrison in EPA Region 8. How and what factors does a methodology use to convert pounds materials used to CO2 equivalent?
Carlos, yeah, I can take that. We use several different publicly available databases for that. There are probably more robust private databases like EcoInvent, but we used the National Renewable Energy Laboratory inventory, LCI inventory, that's available at www.nrel.gov/LCI. So that was used for several of the parameters, and then some of the other ones were used from the Europa Life Cycle Inventory database, which is a European-based database that also has information. And in a lot of cases, the agreement between those two databases is fairly similar, but those are the two sources that we used primarily because of they were publicly available.
Great.
Now, that being said, that's what we have at this point. I presume that there will be a mechanism for updating these values or using more robust values, especially for parameters that are not provided by those databases.
And a lot of the information that we have questions on will be available in the document itself on its release in September. But a lot of the questions I have on hold relate to where are we going with this next. So I'd like to hand it over to Hillary Thornton on slide 58 to finish the last part of the webinar before we wrap up with the other questions. Hillary?
Thank you, Carlos. Moving on from slide 58, the next steps title slide, to slide 59, public feedback. This lays out the timeline for advancing from where we are now, just rolling out an overview of the document without many of the folks on the line having had a chance to see the methodology in full. We anticipate releasing the methodology for understanding and reducing a project's environmental footprint by September 9th, 2011, with a two-month comment period, which would close on November 8th, with a plan then to finalize the methodology, incorporating whatever comments came in during the public feedback period by the end of the calendar year. So if we could move on to slide number 60. Some of you out there may be wondering if there is a tool available. There are lots of tools available, but EPA does not anticipate developing or maintaining a tool for this methodology. EPA has footprint spreadsheets that we use that are generally consistent with the methodology, and the spreadsheets will be consistent with the final methodology and will be made available on CLUIN.org. Green remediation. Once the methodology is final, EPA green remediation coordinators and the EPA engineering forum will be available to answer questions regarding the methodology. Slide 61, please. I mentioned a few moments ago that there are other tools available. Other organizations have developed tools for footprint analysis site-wise, the sustainable remediation tool, Golder Set, Balance E3, life cycle assessment tools, and GSRX are among those tools that are out there. They're not standardized or benchmarked against the methodology as of yet. The tools may or may not be consistent with the methodology. And as folks get a chance to look at the methodology, the tools may become consistent with it. But as highlighted in the blue box at the bottom of the slide, EPA will not endorse individual tools. Different tools will make more sense for different sites. It's going to be a site-specific decision which ones are best. We do hope that through the process of familiarizing yourselves with the methodology and discussing it with EPA, that you'll get in a better position to decide which tool would be most appropriate for your project. Moving on to slide 62, training and tech transfer. We've got a number of things, including today's webinar, that will help folks get familiar with the methodology and begin to apply it. There's going to be more training via internet seminars. This won't be the last one. There'll be training conducted in the 10 EPA regions, and there will be additional example applications and case studies posted on CLUIN in the green remediation focus area. Slide 63 shows other green remediation resources and tools. Once again, CLUIN.org green remediation focus is your one-stop shop. The website has a BMP toolkit, a contracting toolkit, footprint evaluation tools and examples, the 28 site profiles that Carlos referenced earlier, as well as headquarters and regional policies and strategies. There's news, training, and information on upcoming conferences. All sorts of good information out there on green remediation resources and tools. That completes my slides, and as Carlos prepares to open the floor for more questions, I'll address the question that came in that Carlos asked me to make a note of about whether the methodology will enable RPMs to visually distinguish between different LCA approaches. I think that the methodology, as I alluded to on the slides about the tools, it will certainly be helpful to RPMs and other project managers to decide which tools would be most appropriate for their projects and to know which factors to consider in evaluating footprint analysis or LCA input that may come in from consultants or others. But as far as visually distinguishing between different LCA approaches, I wouldn't think that it really does that.
Okay, thank you very much, Hillary. We have some additional questions which you may take or anybody else in on the call related to going forward. One from Scott McDonough in ACOM in Albany, New York. Will flexibility be built into the tool to allow for the introduction and calculation of materials or processes not included in your current tool? And I guess the first thing I'd do is clarify that this is not specifically exactly a tool. It's a footprint evaluation methodology, which is a bit of a roadmap to using any tool you decide to use or what to ask of it, et cetera. But anybody else on the call?
This is Karen Sherman. So I do think that the methodology is very flexible to allow the user to add on more metrics if they want or to address the existing metrics in more complete or different ways. I would just say that the user would want to document clearly if there's anything in addition or different that they do. The methodology is set up to help the user think through what to think about when doing a footprint analysis and to give some clear concrete sort of ways to calculate a footprint. So, again, if there are embellishments or improvements that the user wants to apply, the methodology is certainly very flexible in order and would be able to accommodate those.
Thank you, Karen. Questions on the phone lines? Okay, I'll take another one from the Internet. Does this method, can this methodology be applied to other countries or only the USA? This is from a consulting firm in Santa Cruz in Bolivia. And I guess I'd say that indeed it applies. It can be used at any country or any cleanup program. The question is, in what framework will the information generated by this these evaluations be used? Okay, we have a good question here that we've discussed a lot, and it relates to the agency's participation in the ASTM standards development process for green sustainable remediation. What incentive tool will US EPA use to promote PRP use of this methodology? And I guess more than use of this methodology, it's results achieved through footprint reduction efforts in this methodology. It's a great question. It's a very broad one because it depends a lot on the program we're looking at. That's certainly something that we're exploring as we continue to participate in the development of the ASTM standards. What toolkit of incentives do we have available to support PRPs or to recognize projects where PRPs take action to reduce environmental footprints? Let me see if anybody on the call wants to address that.
Carlos, this is Karen Sherman again. And although I'm not in the Superfund program, I would just say that regardless of whether it's PRPs or whether it's in the RCRA corrective action program or whatever cleanup program we may be in, one way that I think that EPA will be encouraging site owners to apply the methodology is to simply on one-on-one conversations and just as we work with our colleagues in the site cleanup arena, we will always be asking those questions, like you mentioned, Carlos, that, you know, what are the opportunities for reducing our footprint from the cleanup? How can we quantify the footprints that we have now, and how can we reduce them? And then I think we will, in those conversations, we will be encouraging our own EPA staff to make sure that the site owners are aware of the methodology and perhaps even encourage them to apply the methodology and to provide us the results of what they find when they apply the methodology. So, as Carlos mentioned, there's not ever going to be, or there isn't now, a formal requirement that a PRP or a site owner has to do a footprint analysis, but it's something that I think our RPMs and our project managers will begin discussing with the site owners and encouraging them to provide us that kind of information. And again, using the methodology, that's how we'll be evaluating anything that we receive from site owners, is by seeing how it measures up to this methodology.
Thanks, Karen.
Yeah. And I would just add to that, Karen, too, is that it goes back to one of my slides, which is, you know, what we're talking about doing here is just good science and engineering, and it's what we should be doing on all of our projects anyways, and we're really promoting it as that.
Great. A couple of questions specific to the methodology itself again. Again, from our colleague, Dale Carpenter in Region 2, why are we not using existing EPA calculators and tools that take into account LCA information for the conversion step? So I guess maybe Karen or Doug?
Karen, do you want that or?
I'll start. So I don't know that there, the question was phrased in why aren't we using EPA generated LCA tools, and I have to say I'm not aware of any EPA sanctioned or generated LCA tools. We do have at EPA a number of footprint calculation tools of one sort or another. For example, in our waste program, we have the WARM model, and there are other sort of calculation tools like that. Each of them that I'm aware of don't calculate the entire the full range of metrics that we're recommending in this methodology, for one. And none of them that I'm aware of are actually life cycle assessment tools. So I guess, Dale, maybe we could be in conversation on this if you're aware of more that that are life cycle assessment tools. But that's what I'm aware of at this point, that we don't actually have any that are life cycle assessment tools at this point.
At least for that portion of the conversion process where we're going from a pound of material to a, say, a certain type of pollutant that's emitted.
Okay. Broader question. This one is more specific to Superfund from Melissa Moore on CH2M in Denver. For current feasibility studies that are intending to incorporate sustainability analysis as part of the criteria evaluation, does EPA have a preference over how it should be evaluated? Should these be incorporated as part of the short-term effectiveness criteria or included separately? Kira, you've had some experience with that. Do you want to share your thoughts?
How I have done that in the past on the projects that I've done in the last few years is it is being done as something, because it really feeds into to many of the 9 criteria. So it's something that I discuss and on the side, not necessarily under only one criteria, and it doesn't get included. Where we get into problems is where people are trying to include it in the section where you look at the comparison of alternatives. I think that you're going to get a lot of pushback from a lot of RPMs if you're trying to put it in there. So I personally feel that from the standpoint of the FS that it's better brought in as kind of a separate discussion. And then it can be brought in the outputs of your analysis and how it might impact the various 9 criteria can be discussed under each of the criteria, but not brought in as something that looks like it's a separate criteria from the 9 criteria.
Kira, this is Jeff in Region 9. I just wanted to point out that there's a fairly extensive national discussion going on now on the policy approach that we might take to integrating GR into the remedy process, selection process. So just to point that out, that EPA is still sorting and working on and trying to sort that out.
Yeah, and as we said, as if we have said in the past, I think anybody looking out for that, don't expect any significant changes, just some clarification of how existing 9 criteria process can use this information. We have a question here. Subject is documentation for emission factors. Will all of the emission factors in the reference tables and spreadsheets that accompany the methodology contain full documentation, data quality indicators, and explanation of assumptions and uncertainty, et cetera, with references? This is from Angela Fisher with GE and Niskayuna, New York.
Certainly this is Doug speaking. Certainly all the reference factors that we include will include references, or all the conversion factors that we include will include references. Now, whether we provide all the information that Angela just mentioned in the actual reference, in the actual table, or in the actual document, that might get a little lengthy, but we could probably provide an indication of that, and then more detail can be found with the reference.
Okay. Any additional questions from the phone lines? Okay. I think we've addressed most of the questions on the Internet. There are still a few, but I think we've covered them with other questions that have been asked. Please note that on slide 65, we have links to additional resources related to this webinar. And also a link to the feedback form, which we greatly appreciate your feedback on. I'll leave it open. Hillary, anything else that we need to share with everybody or anybody else on the speakers?
Nothing else from me. Thanks.
Okay, we'll leave it at that then. Thank you, everybody, for participating. We appreciate your interest, your questions, and your participation, and we look forward to speaking with you again sometime after September 9th. Bye-bye.